On Monday, August 8th, Tall Can Audio hits 1,000 episodes.
Wait, that's still on? Who could possibly still care?
And the gang is all here to celebrate.
It's euphoric. It's got to be close to nirvana. It's outstanding.
For the first time ever, Maddie, Michaela, Rob, and Matt are all live in studio together.
It's happening, you guys! It's happening! Oh, my God, guys! Oh, my God! I wish you all were here!
Is this likely to go well?
Just check my notes here. No!
At least it will make a lot of noise.
Boom. Here comes the boom.
1,000 pods and 1,000 pints.
I don't think I've ever been as proud in my entire life.
TCA 1000 drops Monday, August 8th, wherever you find low-quality podcasts.
Fuck, it's out of control. Shit.
Welcome to Tall Can Sports. Nate Sager of Yahoo back with us again. How's it going today, my friend?
Good, good. I just have those words, Mike Trout, running through my head right now.
As we sit down and do this, the day after the MLB All-Star Game, his name has been pretty much everywhere, and we will get to that. But before last night's All-Star Game, Major League Baseball unveiled, I guess what they were calling the Franchise Four for every team, and that included Pete Rose for the Cincinnati Reds. And since the All-Star Game was in Cincinnati, they allowed him to be part of it. For people who don't know, Pete Rose is banned from all baseball events, having been accused of gambling during his, until recently, not really during his career as a player, but only as a manager. He's set up and down. He never bet on his own games. And then he only bet on his team to win. And it's all kind of this weird gray. There's a ton of history out there on Pete Rose if you're interested in that. The point here being, he was allowed to participate, which even a couple of years ago, maybe under Bud Selig, would probably have been unthinkable. What are your thoughts, before we get into the whole thing on the Hall of Fame and all that, on just allowing him to be part of this in Cincinnati?
You have to have Pete Rose there for that. I mean, the fans vote. It was a fan vote, I think, for the Franchise Four. He's still revered in Cincinnati, just the way, you know, Barry Bonds is still revered in San Francisco, similarly. And And, I mean, you can't deny that. And this was something Bud Selig approved. It's kind of on the way out of the door, you know, kind of the way the president pardons people in his last days in office, saying, yeah, okay, he's got to be there. And they've allowed it for other things. So, obviously, most notoriously, when they picked the All-Century team in 1999, the infamous Jim Gray on-field interview. Yeah.
Where he was just all over him. For people who haven't seen it, just, are you ready to admit you get, like, you turned this moment, if you want to call it that, night into
an act of journalism was committed that night at Turner Field. Yes,
I thought it was a little bit of over the top journalism. Maybe. Personally, once he didn't answer your question the first two or three times, carry on, because now you're just
belaboring it.
Yeah, exactly. So
it got into hectoring.
You're right, though. It was a legitimate question to ask him.
And Pete Rose instantly, you know, the ultimate get up on the cross, even though we need the lumber guy. It's like, I can't believe you'd ask me that. It was just like, well, you've spent like years and years denying it. And then, of course, over the, you know, then you finally admitted it when you had a book to sell.
Right.
But yeah, it has sort of touched off a whole debate that I'm sure you want to get into.
Yeah, and for people who don't follow baseball all that strong, if you're a baseball fan at all, you know who Pete Rose is. Over 4,200 hits in his career. By the numbers, easily Hall of Fame caliber, right? It's got nothing to do with his on-field performance. He's easily, if Pete Rose isn't a Hall of Famer, no one is, if you look at their statistics, right? I think that's still that number 4,200 is still the
yeah 4,256 all-time leader.
Yeah,
I know when Bill James did his book where he picked the 100 best players at each position, he had Pete Rose as the fifth. You know, and you can only be ranked at one position, which is great to conundrum with Pete Rose because he was an all-star at five different positions,
yes.
Like both corner outfields, both corner infields, and second base, where he started out. And I mean, the only four right fielders ahead of him, respectively, are Babe Ruth, Henry Aaron, Frank Robinson, and Mel Ott. Like all guys who hit 500 home runs, and Rose was basically a gap power type guy. So that, I mean, he had him ahead of Reggie Jackson. That's why when people say should Pete Rose be in the Hall of Fame, philosophically, yes, he has to be, but procedurally. No, he can't be.
So it's
he bet on games involving his own team. He manipulated lineups. To me, the media just dumbs it down to this yes/no question. But to me, it's a moot point because
it's Rule 21D. I've looked it up, and it's I don't want to read the whole legal wording of it, but basically, it's a 1-year suspension or ban if you bet on games that don't involve your team, and it is unequivocally. White, black and white writing, lifetime ban if you bet on games that are involving your own team. Even if you're betting on your team to win, which in theory would mean, you know, you're still putting forward the best possible effort you can. And again,
but that mean which could conceivably mean that you'd, you know, not know when not to bet on your team, right?
Yep, that's right. And so that was something that just came out, a study in the last year or two that said. He didn't bet on his team when he was managing when there was two out of his five pitchers started his presumably his fourth and fifth pitchers. He didn't bet on his team when they were starting, and people went back through all the books and looked at it and said that's not true. When he bet, it had nothing to do. Those two guys were just as often bet on as so it doesn't matter in that he did bet on his own games. But there's no evidence so far to suggest he ever bet on his team to lose.
Yeah.
Which is the real problem, right? Now all of a sudden you're pulling players out of the lineup or you're... If you're betting on your team to win, you should always be doing everything you can to win anyway.
Yeah. But then you're possibly, you know, you're playing with the playing hell with the integrity of the games you're not betting on.
Yep.
And nope. That's inside information, like... to me, it's it's kind of a don't shit where you eat thing. Like, you know, people who work in a Las Vegas casino as dealers aren't allowed to come back and play at the same tables. Cause then it's, how does that look to other gamblers?
Absolutely. Yeah. You finish your shift and switch to the other side of the table.
Yeah. It looks like the money's, you know, coming in one door and going out the other.
Yeah.
And obviously baseball, you know, is always, and I really don't care that, you know, I think public attitudes towards, you know, gambling, I think, have softened a lot in the last quarter century. I mean, at that time, I think there was only two U.S. states where it was legal, New Jersey and Nevada. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, now, I mean, every, you know, there's state-sponsored sports lotteries. I mean, and what is fantasy sports, really? But, you know, a legitimized form of gambling. I mean, if you pay, you know, $20 to be in your league or whatever, or $200. But I don't think that necessarily matters because, like you said, Matt, the rules were spelled out, and I don't know why people can't get that, or why the public cares. But to me, it's like almost like the death of critical thinking here, because it's like everyone learns everything by rote; they don't know how to ask the right questions. But to me, or maybe it's the Rickeying of society where everyone just thinks these rules are optional or something. I'm just gonna take the furniture out of this motel room and sell it. No one said I could, but I mean, this was spelled out like you said, and it's a shame because, like, yes, he should be there. I mean, should Pete Rose be in the Hall of Fame? Yes, but Pete Rose didn't do anything to help Pete Rose, and I think Major League Baseball and the Baseball Hall of Fame and the writers who vote for it mucked up how to make that happen.
Right,
way back in the late '80s and '90s.
So let me come at it from a different perspective, and I'll ask it a different way because. I have seen this argument a few times. Obviously, this comes in waves. Every time there's a Pete Rose story, this debate gets all flared up again. And so now you're having the All-Star game in Cincinnati where he made his name. You know, he probably did. He played briefly in Montreal.
He did, yeah.
Yeah, less than a season, but...
Hit 260.
Yeah.
Made about 265 for a half season with the Expos.
I had no idea.
Got his 4,000th hit with the Expos.
I know, that's kind of interesting. I had no idea till I went and I was doing some research on this because it's such a brief stop on the on the roadmap. But you know, as this blew up again around this story, and it seems like every couple of years it happens. The other argument that I was seeing quite a bit was, okay, he was guilty, and he broke the rule. There was no doubt about it. He's admitted to it. It says lifetime ban. I think it's been 26 years, something like that.
Yeah, it happened in the summer of 1989.
Right. Has he, because he's obviously never going to play again. He's obviously, no one's going to hire him to manage again. Has he served enough time? Was it time to just say, okay, like, you're not allowed to work for Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
But you can be at these functions. If we're going to throw it back in the Hall of Fame writers' hands, if they think you're whatever, is it time to just...
I do hear this a lot, like 25 years is long enough. And I'm not saying that's what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm just asking the question right now.
Like, I mean, I've heard people even say, well, you know, guys, someone kills a guy, they can get out after 25 years.
Right.
But that's sort of ignoring the concept of rehabilitation. Like, here's a, like, and that comes back to the point that Pete Rose hasn't helped out Pete Rose, right?
I mean, oh, he was such an asshole for so long.
Yeah, he's there at every induction weekend down the street, you know, selling autographs
and
overshadowing
sports,
the players getting in there.
We talked about the fact that I had been there the year Cal Ripken went into Cooperstown, and he was sitting there in the back of some baseball shop selling his autograph for more than absolutely any other legend. And from what I recall, there was nothing in terms of a lineup, right? Like, he doesn't look up, he doesn't talk to you, just give me your $50 or whatever and slide it in front of
him. And that's really pissed off a lot of the players of his vintage who have gone in, like that he overshadows the players who are being inducted. And people have been really vocal about how it's ticked them off. Like, I know Goose Gossage just said some things, and Johnny Bench, you know, his teammate Cincinnati's like, he's said several times, Pete's got to go get help. Like, he was a compulsive gambler and he's been in denial. It's almost like Rob Ford type behavior. And I know you shouldn't make fun of Rob Ford. I mean, that's low hanging fruit, and he's out of office. And
somebody who clearly needed help.
But he was someone who clearly needed help and would always just think that all this attention was automatic approval of his actions. And when it isn't, and then it was always trying, like, well, I haven't done anything that anyone else hasn't done. And, you know, trying to normalize the abnormal behavior. But so I don't really buy the whole 25 years is long enough, because I haven't seen the whole evidence of, you know, rehabilitation and an honest approach to addiction, like, say, there was, you know, recently with Josh Hamilton. And, and there's always this, you know, other guys did steroids, other guys did that.
Other debate, right?
Yeah, you're getting into, like, I think this guy was an alcoholic, or this guy was a racist. I mean, that's getting into moral stuff.
Ty Cobb.
Yeah, Ty Cobb. That's getting into moral stuff when this is actually about ethics, you know, like, you know, which is, you know, practicing your morals within your job.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't buy that either. I think the steroid thing is a false equivalency. And I even heard one guy say, well, steroids are just a recent thing. I'm like, really?
Because not so much.
Athletes have ingested testosterone since back in Athens in 3,000 years ago.
Right.
I'm not making that up. So that just ignores the culture of the game. Like, that for generations, because of what happened with the 1919 Chicago White Sox and possibly a few other teams before them, because I think there's been evidence to surface that the 1918 Cubs also might have thrown the World Series.
Yeah.
And it certainly didn't happen. And the Black Sox certainly didn't come in a vacuum. That, you know,
no, certainly
it was
not
something that was spelled out to every player.
Yeah.
That you, I mean, doesn't matter whether you go to the racetrack on your off days or your owner, you know, plays the ponies, or this is still something we have to maintain a pretense of. And, you know, one guy just in how many, you know, generations decided, you know, I'm not going to play that, because he got so carried away with his gambling addiction.
Right.
And it's an American tragedy.
Well, to me, the only link that, because I agree, the steroid thing is a false equivalency. However, it's been left up to baseball writers to pick and choose and guess and whatever. Well, this guy was probably on it. This guy hit this many home runs. Yeah, okay, but against a pitcher who was probably just jacked up as he was. And, like, it just, to me, there is an equivalency there only in that that also was against the rules, or against the law, if nothing else.
Yeah.
And maybe those guys, you know, can't get jobs in baseball now. I don't know. But it was left up to Hall of Fame writers, right, and veterans committees, whatever, to make those decisions. And that might be the only thing that I see different here. Okay, you're not going to allow Pete Rose back in to ever manage or GM or whatever job he might be able to find in baseball, but maybe he should be thrown back again. If we're letting just sports writers decide arbitrarily that, oh, I think, you know, Rafael Palmeiro told the truth and he wasn't on steroids, but Roger Clemens was because he's an asshole. I don't know who you are to make that decision, but if that's how we're going to do it, then why isn't Pete Rose in that pile and go, well, you broke this rule, but I... You
know. Yeah, that's a great point, because I think a lot of things the media skips over with this. And the big one was the whole way the permanently ineligible... The Pete Rose rule was snuck through, but I guess a year and a bit after Pete Rose was banned in August 89, they passed this rule. No one who's on the permanently ineligible list, which was one guy,
yes.
Pete Rose,
yeah.
can appear on the Baseball Writers Association of America ballot, which is the one that they collect votes on at the tail end of the year, and it's announced in early January. And I guess just to explain it, basically from the point you play your last game, so Derek Jeter, for instance, played his last game in 2014, so there's a five-year waiting period plus one, so he goes on the ballot in 2020.
Right.
So Pete Rose would have gone on the ballot in 1992.
Right.
So in 91, they passed this rule, and I think they really took the bat out of their own hands, and that's really disappointing because I always think of, you know, the Edmund Burke saying, you know, your representative owes you not only his labor but his judgment, and they forfeit that when they go with the popular whim, because everyone just wanted to see Pete Rose suffer. And that,
yep.
That's a particularly American thing. At the end of a historical period, like the end of a decade, okay, whose head are we going to put on a pike here? Like, and it's always a sports scandal, right?
But it's that like, is, it's very much like
we're
that.
We're going to take down Pete Rose, and we're not going to talk about Iran Contra.
But we love the idea of tearing someone that we perceive to be above us down, and then... Look, you're not so great.
Go
and then in
the
a couple of years,
fruit.
Let's build him back up, because we love a recovery story too, right? We love
Americans.
Everyone's
love
tried so hard to get back behind Tiger Woods, but he just can't do it.
Oh,
anymore.
Tiger Woods is a great example.
But people
of that.
Loved tearing him down,
like,
right?
At the end
like,
of the last decade,
asshole.
all of a sudden, everyone cared about Tiger Woods' sex life,
right?
And then everyone cared about the size of Barry Bonds' head, or they all were like, oh, how could LeBron James go sign that ridiculous contract? And it wasn't like, well, let's not talk about, you know, like Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld and all those guys being war
criminals.
Yeah,
that stuff's complicated. I don't want to
understand.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying that we're...
Tiger Woods had sex with people that weren't his wife. Let's talk about that, because that's what's really important.
He slept with a Waffle House waitress. And we're not above that. We're in the shit on that. But we're just saying to people, you know, don't fall into the manufactured outrage or thinking in, you know, absolutes. But I guess just getting back to Pete Rose, I mean, the way they did that to me was like I said, they took the bat out of their own hands.
Yep.
And it's funny, I went back and when we said Matt that we were going to get into this, so I guess I'm, you know, passionate about it. I was, you know, the golden age of sports is from age 8 to 12, and I was 12 when this happened, so I guess I have a pretty avid interest in it.
Right.
So, I mean, to me, like, I went back, looked at the BBWAA ballots from the early 90s. And if you'd put him on the ballot in 92, I mean, if nothing had happened, like if everyone just said, well, he's a bad guy, but we don't have the goods on him, he would have gone in with probably, I would say, somewhere in the low 90s. There would have been some sports writers that would have been like, I don't like that guy.
They
would have voted for him. Because I think Reggie Jackson went in around the same time. He got like 93%.
Right.
I was surprised Joe Morgan only got 90%. He was like the best second baseman ever. But I guess, you know, he walked a lot and didn't have a high batting average.
Right.
But then I look like 92, Tom Seaver. And then you got to wonder, like, is it fair to Tom Seaver that he's going to have to be up on the dais with Pete Rose, like, after everything that's gone down? You know, 93, you would have had Reggie Jackson and Pete Rose. I don't think you could build a stage to hold the egos there. 94 was Steve Carlton. 95 was Mike Schmidt. And, you know, Carlton and Rose were both teammates,
yeah.
Or Carlton and Schmidt were both teammates of Rose with the Phillies.
Yep.
So then it becomes that question every year. Like, and then, you know, you have to talk about it. Would he have gone from being a surefire first ballot guy to,
oh,
you know,
yeah,
down in the range where Clemens and Bonds are, where they're I think they both, you know, got support in the high 30s this time. Or Mark McGwire only got 10%. He's been on the ballot for 9 years. Does he suffer that fate? And then you could have just run the clock out on him. Or maybe you could have convinced him to do more and say, I had a gambling problem. Here's what I'm doing about it. And, you know, that fits in the whole idea of, you know, restorative justice. He goes around and says to all his teammates, like, I'm sorry that you guys have to be asked about me every time, you know?
Yeah.
Because I know, like I was saying, Johnny Bench, you know, I've seen enough quotes from him. He's just pissed off that he gets asked about Pete Rose more than he gets asked about his own Hall of Fame career.
And there's certainly something to that. And we're going to start to segue off of this. I'll give you, you know, a chance to go. For me, it's really simple to me. He broke rules, black and white rules. There's no argument. He's admitted to doing it. My deal is you have guys in there who have admitted to being on steroids. You have guys in there who are not necessarily admitted, but pretty clearly racist. It's not the hall of nice guys.
No, it isn't.
It's the hall of I hit 4,200 goddamn times in the major leagues. And I guess if you want to try and have this moral standing around the Hall of Fame, good luck to you. But to me, that was flushed decades ago. And when I make the trip to some pissant little town like Cooperstown in upstate New York to see baseball legends and the best of the best, I don't care. Put it on the bottom of his plaque that he got busted for betting on his own team. But I think that could go on Ty Cobb's plaque. I think that could go on any number of different guys that did that wasn't any good.
Like,
let me see 4,200 hits in the Hall of Fame. Because to me, this moral standing that they pretend they're holding holds no water to me whatsoever, because they've let in worse characters than this in the past. So that's kind of my takeaway on it. He broke the rule. Pile of guys in there with broken rules, and they got in anyway. So
yeah, go back to what I said. Should he be there? Yes, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, all-time, you know, leader in hits, an MVP, all-star at several positions, part of, I don't know, I've forgotten how many pennant winners. six pennant winners.
That famed Big Red Machine in Cincinnati, right? Like, it's, it would be nice if everyone in there was great guys, and we could all point with our kids and say those are the people you want to be like. Honestly, if you're putting athletes up on a pedestal for your kids, you're probably asking for them to be let down.
Baseball always inflicts this double standard on itself. Like, hey, I went to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. OJ's there.
Yeah.
I mean, Lawrence Taylor, I mean, had his issues with addiction. And, I mean, no one, you know, tried to punish him by not voting him into the Pro Football Hall of Fame or making him wait a couple of years. But
right.
So, I mean, I would like to see it happen, but unfortunately, way back when, they didn't do the right things to handle it, because everyone just wanted to, like I say, have Pete Rose's head on a pike.
And it's just
a shame, because you basically, the unintended consequence was you kept his name out there for 25 years when he could have just...
That's right.
You could have put him on the ballot and just run the clock out on him, and then...
Put him on the ballot and maybe he goes in. Either way, you're not talking about him every time this, you know, the Hall of Fame ballot comes up, and whenever there's an event in Cincinnati or whenever he publishes a new book, you've left him out there to talk and for people to talk about him. And like you said, this could have been handled much any way but this way would have been better.
Like they really should have said, you know, well, they should have done a better job of differentiating banned from working in baseball and, you know, being elected in the Hall of Fame, which is supposed to curate, you know, the game's history and whatnot.
Yeah. So that's probably enough on that kind of depressing story. You know, maybe the best, probably the best hitter of all time. And we spend far more time talking about his gambling addictions than his accomplishments on the field. So
I just got to throw in one last thing.
Sure.
One of my favorite ever Letterman top 10 lists was still top 10 Pete Rose prison activities. And one of them was practicing his famous head first slide until he burrows his way to freedom. Got any gum?
So I wish I had the glass breaking sound effect for it. We'll carry on. Did you happen to, you said last week you're not much into these All-Star games. Did you happen to see the Home Run Derby this year?
I was playing hockey on Monday night, okay. though, so I did catch it though. Great. TV ratings were up 26%. I mean, anytime the TV ratings don't go down for something, yeah. that's a victory for...
It was unbelievable, man.
For TV these days. So
for people who missed it, they added a timed component. I think it was going to be 5 minutes, and they ended up shortening it to four.
Yeah, weather concerns.
Yeah, and so you got each batter... Oh, and you were bracketed, so you only had to beat one guy to move on to the next round. It wasn't the top couple of guys, right? It was you faced off one-on-one against someone.
Single elimination.
Yeah, like a little tournament.
Like a little March Madness thing.
And it was great. And so you had 4 minutes, and you weren't allowed to throw another pitch until the ball that you had just hit had already landed, which was interesting, and it doesn't seem like it would be a big... You're talking, for some guys who hit big, hard line drive home runs have an advantage over the, you know, big, majestic, high,
yeah,
looping.
The ones that should have a flight attendant on
right,
them. Right. Quote Bull Durham.
And that just hang up there for an extra 3 or 4 seconds over the line drive. You know, that adds up. And so Todd Frazier of the Cincinnati Reds ends up winning the whole thing. He faces Albert Pujols in the final. And the crowd is just losing it for him, right? But he had that... I don't know too much about him, but he was driving them out, right? They weren't looping up into the air. And you had one timeout you were allowed to take, and a lot of guys were kind of taking it about 2.5 minutes in to reset.
Well, it's tiring on your arms, right? I mean, it's like being on a driving range.
And so you would kind of, around 2.5 minutes, step back, kind of take a look at where you were at and how many more pitches you needed. And you could kind of see if you only needed one more to win or one more to tie, but you had 30 or 35 seconds left, guys were taking a lot of pitches to wait for that perfect one rather than wear their arms out just hacking away, right? And make sure they got a hold of it. So when each time Todd Frazier came in, his first round, he had to take down Prince Fielder, who's done this a few times, right, and has won it twice. So that was really cool to see. The crowd got right into it. The fact that it had this timed component made it super interesting. The other thing that was really interesting coming out of it was the wide majority of the guys who batted second won, right, in terms of their pairings. So you knew going up how many you needed, and you could kind of time that. This is how many I need to have in the first minute, and this is it allowed you that freedom, like you said, to not just wear your arms out. You could kind of, I can let a couple go here, I'm on pace, I'm okay. And so it'll be interesting to see, because all the higher seeds, everyone was seeded based on how many home runs they've hit this year, were going first, you know, trying to, I guess, put the pressure on or whatever. And I think that's going to probably flip next year, given how big of an advantage going second turned out to be.
It creates the whole upset thing, right? I mean, and Todd Frazier's kind of the guy who would have picked Todd Frazier to win a home run hitting contest when you haven't seen how it was being set up. And I mean, here's someone who has never had the 30 home run season, even though he plays at Great American Ballpark, which is a launch pad. I mean, he's got 20. He will have 30 this season, barring calamity. I mean, he's got 25 right now and leads the league in doubles, and I think he's top five in slugging. And he holds down a key defensive position.
Yep.
So, great to see. I know some people were kind of wondering, well, he had his brother pitching to him, so he got some extra practice or something. And other guys didn't have that, but at the same time, it's entertainment, right? I mean, they basically gave it a... It's a great reboot. I mean, for something that is a staple of the the All-Star festivities on the Monday night, the home run hitting contest, and it's supposed to be entertainment and supposed to be
accessible. When I was a kid, I preferred it to the game. I'd watch it every year. And then the last several years, it's been dull. I haven't really cared too much. It's just, you know, whatever.
And it would take like hours and hours, and there's only so much, you know, Chris Berman you can stomach.
And so when
for me it's about 5 minutes.
Yeah,
worth,
exactly.
Bark, 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 yeah. I'm like, shut up.
And so,
and no one thinks New York Football Giants is clever anymore. the baseball team moved 60 years ago, dude.
Right. So it was kind of I wanted to tune in and give it a chance, and I kind of got distracted, and then I jumped online and everyone was raving about it on Twitter, and I flipped it back, and I was in for probably the whole rest of the thing, right? Like, it was super entertaining. It reinvigorated my interest in it. Just awesome. And I don't think, going forward, I don't think they will go up to 5 minutes you know, even if there are no weather concerns, moving four was enough. You could see some guys starting to get tired by the end. It's a lot of swings and a short
fatigue.
Yeah, I think 4 minutes was perfect, and you're still seeing guys hit 10, 12, 13 home runs, you know, per appearance. So 4 minutes was plenty. I can't imagine they'll change
that. I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities to expand this out. I mean, obviously people are going to scratch out if they get an injury, but I mean, if you're looking to create like programming for MLB Network, you could even like, you know, televise the draw like yep. it would for a soccer tournament.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, why not?
Baseball actually did something innovative. This happens almost never.
Not since 1897.
It took them, 35 years of talking about interleague play to actually get it?
Yeah, now I'm sick of that too.
Yeah. I'm not a big interleague guy.
So, going into the game, it's funny to hear beforehand they had these ceremonies. They announced each team's franchise four. Do you want to take a guess at who the Jays had?
Oh, it was
so seen it.
Alomar, Halliday.
Yep.
Joe Carter.
Yep. Blech.
And the other guy.
Carlos Delgado.
Yeah. Joe Carter being on there is a bit of a joke to me, but.
Well, I guess it's hard, right, with that one moment.
Yeah.
You know, he was a good player. 30 and 100 and.
With about a 300 on base percentage and a whole bunch of throwing errors.
So take him out. Who would you rather have?
Dave Steve. The problem is there's a recency bias with these things, right?
Of course, yeah.
I mean, unless someone was, you know, a Hall of Famer or multi-MVP or Cy Young winner, they're likely to be forgotten. And Dave Steve was, you know, starring for the Jays at a time when they didn't get a lot of...
Right.
Well, probably about the same amount of media attention in the U.S. I mean, he probably should have won a couple Cy Young awards in the 80s, but... didn't ring up those 20-win seasons when people cared about that,
right.
Thought that was a thing.
Yeah.
And fortunately, you know, he didn't have that long career, so Dave Steve's kind of been forgotten. But if you look it up on Baseball Reference, you know, wins above replacement, he's still the franchise's all-time leader ahead of Roy Halladay and way ahead of Jimmy Key.
Right.
And Joe Carter, when it comes to, you know, rate stats in Blue Jays history, is nowhere near the top.
So who would you know, is there another name other than Steve in terms of position players that would have, Manny Lee, I know you're a fan.
Well, Tony Fernandez is up there in all the categories.
Right.
Too. He was considered at the time he retired probably one of the top 25 or 30 shortstops to ever play.
See, to me it kinda
wasn't a guy you bought a ticket to play.
Delgado was the best Blue Jay in a terrible Blue Jays era. Right? Like He hit a lot of home runs.
He's Todd Helton, basically.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. And, like, really...
Fantasy baseball nuts knew him, but I don't think a lot of other people did.
Is it, you know, maybe more of a statement on the franchise itself than these players, than the fact that you ended up with these as your...
Oh, I mean, the Jays, 40 years is a relatively short time for a baseball franchise.
I suppose, but
they haven't had that... I mean, Delgado and Halliday and Steve are about it for... you know, homegrown superstars, and Alomar had a 5-year run during a Hall of Fame career. So, I mean, that's to me those are the four guys, and the,
yep.
You know, on the Mount Jaysmore. I want to go to Mount Jaysmore.
You're the only one, man.
Take me now. yeah, they've been stuck in the slide for the last 22 years.
Yeah, so that was interesting. They brought out an all-time four for Major League Baseball, which was Sandy Koufax, Johnny Bench. Oh, I'm gonna forget Hank Aaron. Oh, I knew I was gonna forget someone. I didn't put this in my notes. And another guy. Anyway, so for the ceremonial first pitch, it was Sandy Koufax to Johnny Bench, which is kind of a cool moment for people to see. Pretty funny during the player introductions, you know, a lot of the Cardinals getting booed, right? some rivals like that, and even Pujols now as an Angel took it pretty hard from the Cincinnati fans, so that was kind of fun. They were hyping up and talking a lot, going into this as Cranky was taking the mound for the NL to lead off the game. He'd gone 35 innings without giving up a run, and Mike Trout steps up as the leadoff guy and smashes a run right off the bat. So
great. Now we got controversy if he breaks Oral Hershiser's record, right? Oh, he gave up a run in the All-Star game. And he cost the NL home field advantage in the World Series.
Yeah, let's not even get into that again.
What a showcase for Mike Trout. I mean,
that single gave him, which I guess is a thing I'd never heard of today, the All-Star game cycle.
Yeah.
He'd hit a triple, a double. And someone else would complete the All-Star game cycle later in the night with a home run and a single, Prince Fielder. And what's fascinating to me about that is somewhere along the line he hit an All-Star game triple that I'd like to go back and find.
Was the outfielder he hit it to like signing autographs?
I can't imagine what you have to do to allow Prince Fielder to hit score or to hit a triple. But
I'll always remember like one triple Cecil Fielder hit one time for the Jays, and I think the center fielder fell down.
Oh, I also watched Benji Molina hit one for the Jays. That was pretty fun.
We could go on for hours about fat guys legging out triples. Like, I mean, football has the fat guy touchdown. Baseball has the fat guy triple. Like, I just remember Matt Stairs like legging one out. I'd snuck down into the fifth row behind third base at Rogers Center / Skydome with some friends. Like, bought a 500 level ticket and then just went in and sat where they sat. And you just see Matty Stairs digging around second, the helmet flying off, the sun glistening off his bald head, hitting the dirt head first, you know, stomach first, basically. The place went nuts.
Yeah, there's just something about it, right?
He's like, he's going for
Chuck,
it.
Chuck!
Yeah, I can remember listening on radio, like, the year that John Olerud led the AL in on-base percentage that in 93 when he was, like, flirting with a 500 on-base percentage right. That year, and I think he ended up at, like, 473. And I think he had some 50-some doubles that year, but he had the one triple, and he was, like, the left center, and you could just hear the excitement in Jerry Auer. You know, as Johnny O actually made the turn, because he was probably one of the slowest people ever in baseball who wasn't a Molina.
Right. So, you know, like I said, Fielder hit a home run later. Dozier hit a home run. Trout would get, I think he hit two home runs actually in the game. Like I said, I was pretty tired last night. I fell asleep in it. It held absolutely very little interest compared to what the home run derby did the night before, which is, you know, Donaldson for the Jays walked twice. Russell Martin caught the last couple innings of the game. You know, it was what it was, a 6-3 game. The AL has home field, and, you know, you kind of carry on with a couple of dark nights now in baseball where, you know, there's nothing going on.
I think it is good for the players that they stretch the All-Star break out to 4 days now from when it used to be three.
If they're smart, CFL will take advantage, and they should be plugging games into those holes somehow, right? It was had a weird Monday nighter this week. We're going to get to that here in a second. But
Mike Trout, I mean, it's just crazy. He's on pace, I think, to lead the AL in runs scored for the fourth consecutive year. He's got a stolen base title, a home run title.
Well, it's funny. They were talking about him and Bryce Harper being 23 and 22 years old, between them already having 7 All-Star games between them.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I looked it up. Mike Trout, obviously, was a 25th overall pick after the Jays took Chad Jenkins.
Oh.
But I think it was like no one, like Trout's agent was demanding a huge signing bonus, and that was when the Jays wouldn't go over slot.
Right.
And it was not like, you know, I mean, the MLB amateur draft is more of a crap, even more of a crapshoot than the NHL
draft.
Yeah,
it's not just the Jays. So you can't 23 other you teams can't, passed as well.
Unless it's like in the top 10, you really can't say, why didn't you take that guy?
Right, yeah. Oh, yeah, there is no other sport where it's quite as much of a crap.
Like, I'll accept that argument when it was like the Jays took Ricky Romero and Troy Tulowitzki was the next pick. But I'm not going to take that when you get down.
Why are you doing this to me?
Same reason dinosaurs died, Matt.
Jeez.
Anyway, getting back to Trout, yeah. I mean, he has, I think, 124 homers in his career so far. And the rest of the first round of that draft, including the sandwich picks, 139. So he's almost out-homered the entire first round of the 2009 MLB draft.
Is he the best player in baseball right now for you?
To me, he's got to be. Yeah. I mean, he's appointment viewing.
Yeah, unbelievable for sure.
5-tool player. Man. 6 if you count the hair.
Why wouldn't you? So you know, that's probably it coming out of All-Star Weekend, unless there was anything else you wanted to touch on weekend.
There were a couple innings there. I noticed there were, like, you know, three straight strikeouts, and that sort of touches on a big problem. I think MLBS is an entertainment product.
Yeah, who's the guy?
The ball's not in play enough. Jacob DeGrom went into
DeGrom,
like,
yeah.
He whiffed, like, three guys
on
10 pitches.
Get through the inning. Not
but
bad.
I guess I'm a hypocrite to bemoan that when I have him on my Strat-O-Matic franchise. But.
So, yeah, all in all, I think this one will be fondly remembered more than some of the others, but I think that's going to have a lot to do with the home run derby itself. That was a blast to watch. The game was going to have a hard time following that, right? So, I got a quick hockey note here, and we got some CFL stuff. Where do you want to go next?
Oh, we'll get your hockey note out of the way.
My hockey note, I appreciate that. So
I was like, huh? Who? Yeah. Kessler?
Ryan what? Kessler just signs a
the
new
tennis
deal.
Tennis player?
Ugh. Ryan Kessler signs a new deal with the Ducks. This just came out just before we went on air here Wednesday this week. $41.25 million over 6 years for a almost 31-year-old player who's had tons of injuries and plays a hard physical style. To me, I can't. That's almost $6.85 million a year is the cap, the average over the, for a guy that went. And this contract isn't for next year. He's got a year left on his deal. That'll kick in when he's 32 and take him to when he's 38 years old.
Who gives that kind of contract to a 30-something defensive forward?
You want to know who?
Sign Patrice Bergeron.
The brand new advisor to the Anaheim Ducks general manager, Dave Nonis, former Maple Leaf genius who got us into the situation that we're in here, has shown up and whispered in Bob Murray's
the
ear.
Clark, so this is like a David Clarkson contract.
Almost, man. It just might be. He's gotten out there just in the nick of time to say to Bob Murray, you should give that guy $7 million a year for the next 6 years.
For that kind
and a no-move clause.
I've heard Ryan Kessler's a nice guy, but no one's a nice guy at that pay rate.
Man, I don't know. Like, when you're that physical, when you play that stuff, I don't know what the hell you're thinking, especially with a no-move clause. And that lasts for 5 years. In the sixth year, presuming he's still got a career going, it goes to a limited no-trade. So, I mean, that's just downright generous of him.
Right? Anywhere but the Leafs? No.
And I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure when he...
ABC contract, anywhere but Canada?
He had a no-trade clause in Vancouver and said the only place he would go was Anaheim or Chicago. And so now, a year or two later, you're trying to renegotiate with him, knowing he doesn't want to go anywhere else, and you still had to give him almost $7 million a year to be your number two center?
Yeah.
Unreal, man. I can't...
You played hardball for a worse contract.
So, there's no need to go too deep into that, but it just makes me super glad that Dave Nonis is out of here and out destroying someone else's franchise at this point. Kudos to you, Bob Murray, for not allowing this to happen to Toronto. CFL, couple of high-scoring games, couple of... Where do you want to start this week?
Well, I mean, obviously our local tackle football concern, the Ottawa Red Blacks.
Oh, and it was a concern.
They ate a bit of a reality sandwich there last Thursday in Edmonton.
Seems like so long ago now.
Yeah, that was the first game of the week.
Yep.
I mean, and they're only... touchdown was a fat guy touchdown. Although, I,
as we just referenced,
according to Deadspin, it was a fat guy touchdown. But I've seen Zach Evans, and he's not. I mean, yes, he's a 300-pound lineman, but the guy—I don't think the guy has an ounce of fat on him. Actually, he used to do some like crazy dance stuff when he was growing up in Regina, if you can believe it.
I can't.
I wrote something about it last year.
Okay.
I don't remember it at the time. It was some sort of, you know, Ukrainian folklore type thing, but. Yeah, you had to be a pretty nimble dude. But yeah,
game, Winnipeg scores zero offensive touchdowns. They get a pick six, four field goals, and a
blocked punt recovered in the end zone.
Yeah, like what the like? I didn't get to see most. I didn't get to see any of that game. Actually, to be honest with you,
they did a pretty good job. Confusing Rakeem Cato, the young quarterback on the Alouettes. It was only his second start game in the league.
And yeah, like he had a hard. He was gonna have a hard time matching up. What he did right the week before, because he had a stellar debut, he was going to be in tough to match that, and you know, going into Winnipeg. But to circle back, I mean, I don't know why I jumped ahead like that, but that Red Blacks game they played on Sunday of week two, is that
Saturday?
Saturday, and then had to play Thursday with Edmonton coming off a bye week, that was never going to be an easy...
To me, I thought that game would be a write-off at all. I mean, two practices, then a travel day out to Edmonton. They're coming off the bye week. They'd had time to get Matt Nichols comfortable. He certainly looked the part. And then the Red Blacks just, you know, I mean, football is about, you know, confidence in yourself and confidence in every other guy. And they started to fray a bit in that game. And, you know, the 46-17 scoreline speaks for itself. But it's interesting that they have a home-and-home with Edmonton.
Yes.
You know, this Friday at TD Place. It's always weird how you have home and homes with teams that you only play twice, you know, that are in the other division.
But I'll have to see them again this season.
Yeah. Well, we'll see you at the Grey Cup.
Yeah.
Earl, we'll see you. Well, we'll see you. You'll come here for the Eastern. You'll cross over and come here for the Eastern semifinal. So
do you see this one going any differently, or is this Edmonton?
I think it goes
better. Right.
I think Edmonton is a pretty decent team. I mean, Adarius Bowman is, you know, to me, the best receiver in the CFL at the moment, in terms of just, you know, being the league's equivalent to Megatron, you know, Calvin Johnson. Just he can't be, you know, if it's one-on-one and, you know, a 50-50 jump ball, he's probably going to get it.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, the challenge for the Red Blacks will just be stay in the game and, you know, finish some drives early.
And because that was the thing to me, I'm not surprised at all that the offense just didn't have enough time to prepare for Edmonton. And I guess it should be the same for the deep, but that defense for Ottawa has been so good for, I mean, even last year when they were an expansion team, and now this year again, they've looked so, they were just shredded, right? Like, walked into Edmonton and just got torn apart.
I think they lost their composure, a lot of penalties, but CFL game now.
Yeah.
I mean, the league is averaging 28 penalties a game.
Yeah. It's gotten terrible to watch, right?
Hopefully that's not going to continue. Hopefully, I mean, penalties definitely usually are higher early in the season than go down as teams, you know, get more disciplined. But to me, it's like the official, I mean, it's gotten almost as bad as baseball was a few years ago for officials thinking people came to see them. So that certainly took away. They just kind of frayed more and more throughout the game. And, you know, the couple of, you know, bad, and it just mushroomed.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think they necessarily have to win on a Friday to make a statement, but they definitely have to play Edmonton close. I mean, if they can turn, you know, a 29-point spread into, you know, a 1-2 score spread, you know, that's a moral victory. I mean, they're not going to say it's a moral victory, but
you've still got Edmonton on your pro line.
Yeah. You got to look at it in the context of 18 games, and this is a league where you don't have, you know, nobody goes 18-0 in the CFL. No one, I mean, it's rare for anyone to even win more than 14.
The city was getting pretty excited here at 2-0.
I think it might be
tough here at 2-2.
It could have hurt the attendance a little. Plus, I mean, you've probably got a few people who are like, well, you know, Blues Fest, it's the final Friday of Blues Fest. I've got one.
Tragically Hip or on, man. I'll be
You got the Hip or the CFL.
Very Canadian night, either way.
Yeah. Well, what time do the Hip go on? I mean,
9:30. You might be able to.
Conceivably, you could leave at halftime and then.
Well, or if you're getting blown out again.
Yeah. Or who knows? Maybe they'll be up like 42-0. Like I always am in Madden when the game freezes.
Nate the Optimist. There's a side we don't see all the time. That's when the game freezes. Yeah.
He only comes out once every 7 years.
Didn't see a
like
shadow.
Like Vulcan mating rituals. And optimism.
BC 35 over Saskatchewan 32.
Yeah, that was the ultimate no lead is safe game. Right. 11-point game.
Man.
And Saskatchewan couldn't close it out. They get the, you know, touchdown and a 2-point conversion, you know, the shorter 2-point conversion, and then Saskatchewan decides to go third and short from midfield instead of just punting deep.
Man, and you got
BC gets the turnover and a long field goal. And then win it in overtime.
Yeah, and you got to feel for Saskatchewan, right? They're now the only winless team in the league. Like you said, in good shape, it looked like, to get it done. The other thing that, for me, was noteworthy coming out of that one is Kevin Glenn replaces Durant and, you know, has a pretty decent game. He seems to be the perfect CFL backup, right? Like, it never seems to go great with him as the starter, but he's a pretty capable CFL. They put up 32 points. Certainly not
Yeah, he gets the job done well enough.
Yeah, and again, we're sitting here now saying in a loss, but 32 points with your backup quarterback in, and nothing to sneeze at.
I mean, Durant's down for the year, and I mean, Saskatchewan's problems are on defense. I mean, it's certainly not that they haven't gotten the job done offensively, because I mean, here they are, they've scored 40 and 32 in back-to-back weeks and lost both games.
Right.
That's like something out of the early 90s in the CFL. Like, I don't know what, I can't remember too many times a team scored 72 points in 2 weeks and had no W's to show for it.
Unbelievable.
I mean, and both games, I guess we're both in overtime, I think. Yeah, both were in overtime,
back-to-back
too.
Back-to-back overtime games. That's tough.
I mean, that's the thing. When you go on offense first, I think you got to say touchdown. You don't want to just, especially with the way everything's being called now. I mean, you're basically one, you know, jump ball in the end zone and a flag that puts the ball in the 1 yard, a PI flag that puts the ball in the 1 yard line from losing.
Yeah.
Or giving up the touchdown. So to me, I think you got to like go for the touchdown.
I agree. You
can't settle for field goals in overtime
anymore.
Right.
You got to go for it. Calgary 25, Toronto 22. 22 point comeback for
the Argos.
Sorry, no, I've got this the other way around. Yeah, what have I written down here? Calgary defeats Toronto 25-22. Yeah, and to me, it says here that Calgary only had three going into halftime. Came storming back, well, 22 points in the second half.
The big takeaway from that was the Stampeders, had offensive linemen going down like flies. Like, had to run three different guys through right tackle in that game, and they lost, Dan Federkeel, who's, the ratio buster on their offensive line, because he's a Canadian who holds down right tackle, right?
Yep.
And then they lost Edwin Harrison, their American at left tackle. Neither of them finished the game, so they had a Quinn Smith who's listed as a D lineman. they had to put him in it as a guard, I think, at one point just to get through the game. And I mean, that's
you're in trouble now.
Ultimate character win to finish the game with three regular offensive linemen playing and managed to hang on. One interesting thing about that was I still wanted to see how this whole thing with the, I call it the long vert, now that they got to kick the 32 yard extra point.
Yeah.
It still seems like coaches aren't taking enough advantage of it or aren't adapting their strategy to it, because it was a 2-point spread with like 6 minutes left and Calgary takes over, looking to chew clock. And Toronto just sat back in this passive defense and let the, Bo Levi Mitchell obviously wasn't going to be taking any.
One of my favorite names in the CFL. Yeah. Very, very, very quarterback.
Yeah. You name a kid Bo Levi, he's not going to be anything but a quarterback
or
a bank robber.
Maybe a country singer.
He may be a country singer. Bro country, though. I mean, there's enough of that already.
What's up, Bo Levi?
So, and he just like chipped away, dinked and dunked down the field. They took like 5 minutes off the clock, and Rennie Paradis kicks a field goal to put it away, I guess. But I mean, at some point, it's a 2-point game, right?
Yep.
I mean, I know the whole thing is you give up a touchdown, it's nine, but that's not automatic. The extra, that 32 yard.
No,
convert's
exactly.
Not automatic, so I mean, conceivably he could have missed, or you could have blocked it, and you're at eight, and then you're a touchdown, and the shorter two point convert try from tying the game. And I'm surprised Toronto didn't take any chances there.
Yeah,
and as my color guy, when I do U Ottawa football, Nick the Greek always puts it: a man who never took a chance never had a chance. And Nick wants them to go for it on like 3rd and 30, though. And basically, Nick's not like that.
No.
Nick's like, if it's 3rd and anything less than 3, Nick wants to go.
You're
for it.
You're going for it, yeah.
And Nick wants to call onside. So basically, my color guy's an 11-year-old playing Madden.
I don't know. I was pretty aggressive in Madden too. The onside kick's classic.
Oh yeah. If you can get the other person to not, call the onside kick recovery, formation, you're pretty much going to get it.
Yeah. So anything stand out to you in terms of big matchups this week coming forward?
Obviously, you mentioned the Red Blacks games. Just quickly, Paul, can I get some bringing up the CFL schedule on the website like music?
Yeah, I didn't have the forethought to get that in front of me here either as we went into it. So,
yeah, briefly as I sort of click through. Obviously, the Red Blacks need to make a strong response, but I don't think it's as simple as saying you got to win. There's no such thing as a must win game this early in the season, especially when you've already got two in the bank.
Well, and when the East is crippled, right, with quarterbacks down, and you'll hang around for a while here still.
Yeah. Well, Thursday, obviously, Hamilton, Montreal. I mean, to me, I think the Ticats might be the class of the league.
Really, eh?
Well, the way they they put up 50 on Winnipeg and probably should have won that opener in Calgary. I mean, that's one you're going to look back on at the end of the year and say, that could have been anyone's game. It didn't really feel like a loss for Hamilton. You
right.
Because it was week one. It's interdivisional. There's a lot of things in the air. Obviously, a BC-Saskatchewan rematch. That's a must-win for the Rough Riders.
Oh, yeah.
If you're 0-4 and you're in the five-team division...
You're in trouble.
You're in some deep water.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And then Winnipeg-Calgary to finish off the week. That, to me, could be... We'll see how the Stampeders are with the... If they have to reconfigure the offensive line a little, because short week for them with playing Monday and then playing again Saturday.
And coming east.
And having, the two well, it's Calgary's home game.
Okay, yeah, you're right.
And then, of course, Calgary's Ottawa's next opponent, so that's one any of our Bytown-based listeners might want to take note of, as they sit there in the dark and draw circles and X's on the back of pizza boxes. And no, I don't do that during CFL season. Yeah, I do.
So, that's probably it for this week. I think we've covered a lot of ground here, even a little bit of hockey in the dog days of summer. Got plenty of controversial Pete Rose talking. We've got Major League Baseball. So I think moving forward at this point, we're kind of have reached that point of the summer where everything else settles right down to, right? Like NBA free agency is getting pretty much settled. Hockey is what it is. You're into that home stretch for baseball where you're really now only 2 weeks from the trade deadline, and if you're going to make something happen, now would be the time. And I'm looking at you, Anthopoulos, because the Jays have fallen to a game under 500, 4.5 back. Can't afford to go any further. Can't afford to let any more time pass, right? So, beyond that, it's football and baseball here for a little while. Anything else you wanted to touch on in this one? Or?
No. I think we've hit all the major ones. Obviously, I've got a piece up on Yahoo A game tonight. They sort of asked me because, Toronto's hosting the Pan Ams and people are actually starting to like it.
Yeah.
Oh, hey, let's bid for the let's bid for the Olympics.
Yeah.
No.
You'll be paying for that for decades.
I just feel like there should be, if we could put it in here, there'd be like a gif of Apu like doing that slow motion dive to like take a bullet for James Woods. In that Simpsons episode, we're this Winter Olympics powerhouse, but we want to bid for the Summer Olympics in a city that's got like so many social ills right now. It's just unbelievable. I mean, I know the media is just putting that out there.
Yeah, for sure.
It's clickbait, but come on.
But I think it's coming. And Rob and I touched on this in the last one. I'm sure you've got.
I didn't want to cut the grass from the last.
Yeah,
one.
No, and that's great. But you've mentioned it. The Yahoo A game, Nate Sager, there, you should check that out, his piece on it too. I agree that it's a terrible idea, but I think it's happening. I think that's what this Pan Am Games is.
Maybe they won't bid for 2024, but it's because like I say, the previous city council said, no, we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's really time to put a good bid together in two months, because the deadline is September 15th.
That's right.
We've already got a strong contender in the region with Boston bidding, and why don't we let Boston finish ahead of us like they do in hockey and baseball already,
and usually basketball except for the last year.
Yeah, except for the Celtics. I can't rip on the Celtics because Scott Morrison, former CIS coach there at Lakehead, isn't with the Celtics these days.
Yeah,
and Scott's a great guy. Played in the CIS too, so. And he's coached with the Celtics. That's a huge thing.
For sure.
To me, I just would encourage people to sort of look at the fact that the IOC's now said you can have multiple city bids.
Yes.
That was part of the thing that, Thomas Bach brought in, I guess.
Well, then you think the issue becomes if Boston wins, it's another rotation around the world before you're bidding for North America again, right?
That's true, but I just think why bid for summer when there's probably fewer cities going to go for winter, and you've already...
Oh, that's absolutely true.
You've done it twice. You've got facilities that would just need to be improved. You've got a
standing possibility of winning it.
Yeah. You've also got the possibility you could even get creative and partner with a U.S. city. Like, you could do Calgary-Denver.
Yeah.
No,
that's true.
I don't know if Seattle would really be a Winter Olympic city. I mean, granted, neither was Vancouver, but that didn't stop us. Now, did it?
Yeah, exactly.
You could do Vancouver, Calgary, Vancouver, Seattle,
I'll
Calgary.
I'll make damn snow if that's what it takes.
Yeah, there's. I think there's infinitely better. Now, maybe you want to get creative and do a Toronto-Montreal bid.
I think that's what I see as being more likely, rather than a two-nations bid. Like, two cities, I absolutely understand. Trying to get the USOC and the COC working together like that might be a tougher...
Yeah, I think we will see it at some point. I mean, if they could do it for... If Japan and Korea figured it out for a World Cup.
Yep.
Way back when.
True enough.
Anyway, I just hope people would look at that and see there is a potential value in but Toronto in the Summer Olympics this soon? I don't think so.
Probably not. So that's the A game, EHA, of course, the Canadian A, on Yahoo. It's Nate Sager. This has been Tall Can Sports. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Well, this one's empty. For more, visit tallcanaudio.com or find us on Twitter and Facebook at Tall Can Audio.